Audio for the Retro Computing Roundtable is hosted by CyberEars. When you need a rock-solid platform to host and distribute your podcast or other audio media, head over to CyberEars.com. Fast, reliable hosting with unlimited bandwidth. CyberEars is your audio on your terms.
It's February 27th, 2022, and welcome to episode 251 of the Retro Computing Roundtable.
Well, it seems the Emerald City is far behind me now, and my world has changed back from black to white. But no matter where I go, there's just one thing I'd like to know. Will I ever find my way back to us? Will I ever find my way back?
The RCR is a podcast about retro computer news, nostalgia, collecting, music, and the 50s, I guess, and whirlwinds. I don't know. Anyway, it's about whatever we talk about. We'll see what that is. I'm Paul Hagstrom, near Boston. I am joined by two retro computing enthusiasts today. Carrington Manston in Toronto, how are you?
I'm excellent.
Awesome.
I'm awesome. I'm awesomely excellent.
I give you a silent thumbs up for the audio listening audience. Also joining us is Charles Mangan of Unknown Parts of Raleigh. Anyway, how are you?
Like the Andrew Garfield Spider-Man, I'm amazing.
I didn't know you were in Raleigh. I have a sister who lives in Raleigh. That's the end of my story.
Excellent. All right. So,
So banter.
Yes. Here we go. Commence bantering. Beep, boop, beep. Yeah. So I guess the plan that we had started to follow was, with episode 251, we were going to talk about things related to 1951, where the sort of vintage computing era was kind of getting on its feet.
But back then it wasn't vintage.
That's right.
Just fun fact.
Yeah, there was I forget exactly what made me think of this, but for a while leading up to the year 2000, Conan O'Brien on his like late night show would do this segment like in the year 2000, and they'd like, do this like exactly.
Yeah, I remember that. Yeah.
They would do these little like mock future predictions or whatever. But the thing that was cool about that was that he kept doing that well after the year 2000 had already come and gone.
There was a show, I think it was an Australian show called Beyond 2000. Mm-hmm. It was things that are going to come up, things that are going to be in your home in the year beyond the year 2000 or whatever. And after at some point in the late 90s, it was still going on. It was still a show, but they changed it to in the days beyond tomorrow.
Uh-huh.
So in the days beyond tomorrow, it's already the year 2000. So we're going to keep talking about it. Yeah.
It is kind of shocking, though, how long ago 2000 was.
For a year that still sounds like it's kind of in the future. 2001 definitely sounds like it's in the future. I don't care what year it is. That's definitely a future thing. We should have skipped a couple of them. We should have just gone from 1999 to like 2006 or something and then saved a few that were just, 2001, that'll be an amazing year.
Right. Someday. That will always be in the future. Yeah.
Yeah. The year that we finally get jetpacks. That's when we can finally that check that box year. Off.
Yep. Who said all the years have to be in order? How boring.
Yeah, I think there's a Stephen Wright one-liner that's like, why is the alphabet in that order? Is it because of the song? Okay. Anyway, so 1951, a whirlwind year. Carrington has something he wanted to talk about.
Year indeed. I mean, in our show notes, it talks about the Mark I and stuff. Like, there's more famous computers than the Whirlwind, but I have a soft spot for the Whirlwind because nobody ever talks about the Whirlwind. And it seems like this computer has been lost to history, but it was like a cool and important computer. And I learned when I had read about the Whirlwind, I learned about two different things that I didn't know previously. One was, this was the computer when I first learned about magnetic memory, because it was the first computer to use magnetic memory, which is so awesome. But I also learned about other ways to store data, one of which we've talked about in the past and one of which we've never talked about in the past that I always found like mind-blowing. But to talk about the whirlwinds. So in the late 1940s, the U.S. Air Force wanted to make a new style of trainer for pilots, to make a flight simulator, essentially. And so the way trainers used to be done is you'd have a thing called a link trainer, not link as in like linkage, but like there's a person, like this guy, Mr. Link, and he invented a kind of trainer. Because if you're a pilot, like you go into the Air Force, you say, can you fly? Sure, I can fly, because you're like a crop duster. How do you fly? I kind of feel it. The same way, like nowadays, if you've been driving a car for a lot of years, I mean, not like contiguously, but like a lot of years of your life, you've been driving a car. I do look down at my instrument cluster, to use a fancy term for it, to say, look, oh my goodness, I'm speeding or whatever. Is my signal actually on? But for the most part, you can drive by just look around. You can feel it. You just kind of drive. But imagine if we spray painted all your windows black and said, okay, now, Mr. Fancy Driver, how you doing now? And so if you're used to driving little open cockpit planes and crop dusters and stuff, but then you're now going to fly a jet or the 1951 equivalent, well, I don't know what they had. You have to be able to fly by instrument. And so link trainers were these boxes you would put people in and have all the instruments to train a pilot how to fly by instrument, but they weren't computerized things. They were just using gears and pumps and stuff to say, when you push the stick this way, this is what will happen to your instrument, so you can learn how to use a plane. But the Army said, Air Force, the one up. The Air Force said, we want to come up with a different sort of device. We want to come up with a trainer that we can put a pilot in that could be a bunch of different planes. We want to be able to reconfigure it. And we also want to be able to reconfigure it during the flight. The idea is like, okay, you're training. This is what a tailwind's going to do. And so you want to be able to make changes.
Or, you know, sometimes people shoot at you.
Right, and these things happen. But the idea was that you want to be able to fly by instruments and really train somebody in something a little more robust. So they approached MIT, and MIT, a bunch of boffins, as they say at MIT, said, yeah, we can do that. It's 1949 technology. Of course, we got what we need. They didn't have what they need. They had to invent a bunch of things. So they decided, we should make this a computer. It should be a computer-based thing. That's exciting and new. Let's do a computer. So they decided to do originally an analog computer, and that wasn't working. He said, let's do a digital computer. The ENIAC sounds fancy. Maybe we can do a similar sort of thing. And so they create a computer over a few years that then came out in 1951, and it was specifically designed to run these flight simulators. It was a flight simulator computer, but it wasn't like a flight simulator like, you know, Microsoft Flight Simulator. It was a computer that you could hook up to a box that you'd put a pilot in, and it would change all the dials and stuff in response to the pilot doing things with the instruments, and also response to the operators be able to change things on the fly. So because he needed to change things on the fly, that was a very difficult thing for like 1950, 1951 computer to do. And one of the main limitations was how long it takes to interact with a computer. Like if you've got storage and they need to have like a bunch of storage. And so there was only a couple of ways to have, if you want to have like 1 or 2K of storage back then, you could do a Mercury delay line. And we talked about delay lines before in an earlier episode. And I love delay lines because the mechanical ones, you can see the data going around, but it takes a long time. Like you send the bit out and it goes around. And the problem with Mercury delay lines in particular is it's a function of the temperature. Like the amount you can store is based on the ambient temperature or the temperature of the mercury. So you can imagine if you had, how much RAM do you have? Well, I've got 16 gigs up to 20 degrees Celsius. Beyond that, I start to lose RAM.
The other thing about the delay line memory is that it's not random access. You can't say, oh, I need this bit from this byte over here. You have to wait for it to come back by. And if there's, you know, like you've got 2K, you've got to wait for up to 1 and, you know,
right,
you know, 1K to come back to you before you can say, okay, this is that. That's the byte I want.
And they had looked at for this computer, because this was crazy for 1951. This is a parallel processing computer. It does a whole bunch of things. It was the first parallel processing computer, but it was also a 16-bit. It was 16 bits at once, which is crazy. And so they were going to do a bunch of Mercury delay lines and say, okay, it doesn't give you true random access, but it can get you quicker. And it kind of fell apart. But the other way they looked at storage, which was a thing I didn't know was a thing, was electrostatic storage. And I don't think we've ever talked about this before, which is using a cathode ray tube monitor as RAM. Did you guys know that that was a thing? Like, I had never known that that was a thing before reading about this computer.
Only recently did I see a demonstration of it, and it's fascinating. It's like it's right, that's what you're saying. It's a CRT, and it refreshes, and because the phosphors take a little while to delay after they get hit, it's still readable for, you know, a cycle or two after it's been refreshed.
Like, and it's funny because the closest I've ever known about that sort of thing was like with some old computers, like from the era we normally talk about, have chunks of memory that are directly mapped to the monitor. Like the Apple II does that. You've got like, if I put a bit of info here, a dot appears there. And so I'm used to that kind of idea, which to me sounded always like this crazy idea. But WAS or people like a couple of decades older than us would have been aware of these other storage mediums. Said like, no, you can actually, a monitor can be storage, because like you hit it with, like you said, a cathode ray hits the beam, it makes it glow, and basically by adding electrons in there. And the way you clear a cathode ray, imagine if the beam goes down, you say, now I want it to be off, you just hit it with a higher voltage, which wipes it out. And it turns out when you do that, though, it releases those extra electrons, which you can read. So if you send a higher voltage out, you can tell which dots had been lit up and which dots hadn't. And that's how you know that's a one or that's a zero. But in doing so, you also erase the memory. So these memory systems have to have a gun that erases it, a thing that reads it, and another one that, on a feedback loop that writes it back, because you're wiping it out every time you read memory.
So that is actually a little bit like the mercury delay, right? I
mean, yeah,
like
so this idea
you have to keep refreshing it.
Reading it and keep refreshing it. You're always writing it back in and hoping you don't lose power. And so just a really, really neat thing. So they looked at all these and said, none of these are going to work for what we need. We need to invent a new type of way to store things. And it was for this computer that magnetic memory was invented. So it's the people at MIT looking to find a new way of store things for this, read about a new form of magnet, this material that might be used that way, and then spent 2 years trying to come up with magnetic storage, magnetic memory, for this computer. This is the reason we have magnet. I mean, it probably wouldn't have got invented anyway, but this is the computer, first one with it, and it was the reason it got invented. So I've always found it weird that this computer never gets mentioned. It's like such an interesting thing. It's also the very first computer that wasn't a computerized version of something mechanical. Before this, computers were always, we have a thing, like we're going to do a census, we do a thing already, and we want it to be, we want a faster version of that, or we want a better or more accurate version of that. This was a computer where they said, we want a different sort of flight simulator than exists. We want to do a thing that we couldn't do without it being computerized. And so this is the first one of those, where a computer was made to do a thing that is new, that is enabled by computers, not just faster because of computers. So that's like super cool.
I think part of the reason why you didn't hear much about it is that it wasn't a general purpose computer. It wasn't like a UNIVAC that you could just say, okay, now we're going to run census data into it, or now we're going to calculate logarithms with it by reprogramming it. It seems like a very focused single purpose, obviously ahead of its time. If it's, you know, they're having to invent things that didn't exist in the late 40s. Was the magnetic memory in that the like the rope memory that was sort of woven, magnetic rings
magnetic
woven
core,
in a
yeah, exactly. It's exactly what you're talking about. The woven thing, it was 2K. It was a grid of, I think, 32 by 32 or whatever you need to make 2K of memory. Sorry, 2K of memory.
Yeah, two of those. Mm-hmm.
In exactly what you think of as magnetic core memory. It was like they said, oh, yeah, put those little circles as little X's woven in, and bingo, you got yourself memory. And so they said, here's a new way to store things. And
so that hadn't evolved much past that when we were sending people to the moon on Apollo missions with the same kind of memory.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, exactly. And
the rope memory is...
So I love it. So I've always had a soft spot for this computer, because it's like these people said that we want to do this thing and we want to make change. Let's invent like what we think of as a computer. Like there's so many things that it's sort of say, you start with like banging rocks together and you move to, we've got an iPhone in your pocket, and somewhere on there is first computer. And like, it's so hard to argue what is the first of anything, but this is the first computer in a lot of ways. It's like the first thing that is like a computer, not just like a computerized version of something early. It's a thing. We're going to invent a thing to be a computer, to have RAM the way we think of it as, to be like, to be programmed. It's the first computer that wasn't programmed through some sort of batch processing method. All computers before this, you have your stack of cards, you put them in, the computer does a thing and spits out a problem. Or spits out an answer, not a problem. if I programmed it, then... But this was a computer with you programmed the way we think of you program it. You give it a bunch of instructions and then it runs. They wanted to make it more like an engine. So it's going to just be running and then you can adjust it on the fly. Haha. I bet they made that joke a lot. So like that's what I think of a computer. To me, like this is what a computer is. It isn't just a fancy calculator or something or a quasi mechanical thing that takes a bunch of batch cards and says the answer is 7. This is something that says, okay, I'm now running a plane in flight. And you say, okay, now there's this tailwind. Now there's this or this isn't working, and it adjusts it on the fly between the operator and the pilot, and it just operates as a computer program. Like this is so clearly an actual computer without needing to equivocate about like what that term means. And no one ever talks about it. And so I think it's really cool. Way to go, MIT.
Well, and it's a digital computer in the sense that we think of digital computers, and it would be recognizable in a way that some of the earliest digital computers were not. Like, you know, it's a big row of vacuum tubes and valves and things, and you know, mercury delay lines. Like, if you were to walk into a room that was you know a computer, a UNIVAC or whatever, you'd be hard pressed to like say, okay, that's the memory. Or is that the memory? It's all just a bunch of things that have been replaced by newer and faster and you know more digital type things. But if you were to look at at least for me, if I were to look at it and say, okay, there's a whole bunch of magnets in a row, and that's probably some kind of magnetic memory or magnetic storage, or you know, was it? You know, if it was the kind of thing where it was being reconfigured on the fly by someone at a keyboard or at a terminal, something like that, it'd be much more recognizable than someone taking a big stack of punch, you know, wires and patch wires and stuff and slotting it into a slot, because that's how you programmed the earliest machines. It's like, so we have basically a bunch of AND and OR gates, and they're all plugged together with telephone wire, and then we slot that into this giant cartridge. Turn the machine on and hey, it's a different machine now. But yeah, the idea of being able to actually reconfigure it on the fly and let it actually just sort of run, it's like, well, that's like an operating system.
Mm-hmm.
Were there operating systems before that, or were they just programs that ran on hardware?
And even this, is it an operating system? Like it just can do the one thing, but you can change it. Anyway, it's one of these things where I'm so fascinated by this computer, and it's amazing to me that somebody could say, let's invent that. Let's invent a new way to have memory. Let's invent this, like just to have this need and then just create this computerized thing. It's just amazing to me.
Well, if you're a bunch of academics at MIT and the government comes and hands you a big check,
right?
Do you say, no, we can't invent that?
Sure, we can. We got you. We got you. We got that.
I would suppose that, like, if you were, you know, if you were being trained on this thing, you could do better and worse. And, like, there's scales of sort of how you do, which makes me think maybe we could also call this, like, the first video game. First computer game.
Yes, you have failed. Put a quarter in the side.
You have failed slightly better than your comrade here.
So that's it. That's my favorite computer from 1951.
That's pretty cool. I am pretty sure I've never come across that before.
And I think Charles, I always kind of wondered why nobody talked about this. I think Charles, the answer is obvious now that you said it, it's obvious. this was a military thing specifically for flight simulators that the public is never going to hear about or touch. So you can see why this is not in the public consciousness the way a UNIVAC was or the Mark I from 1950 or whatever, because you don't have a bunch of Remington Rand people walking around trying to sell it.
Mm.
True.
And you were saying that you found that a bunch of the like documents got declassified or something fairly recently.
Yes, in 2009. In searching for this, it was 2009. I'll find a link and stick it in the show notes. But there's just a few years ago, a bunch of things about this computer and its development got declassified and then given to MIT, who have now made it, or at that time, I think 2009, made it available to the public. So they stuck on the site. So I'll find a link and stick it in our show notes.
I love it. Yeah, we gave this stuff to the government, and they never gave it back for 50 years.
Did you want to, Charles? Did you also want to talk about the computer music thing in this context?
Yeah, I don't know what the context specifically is about computer generated music, other than the note that's in the show docs. But that reminded me of the artist, and her name is Lori Spiegel, and this is her website, which it looks very vintage, just in and of itself. But the reason that it brought her to mind was that she has a long running history going back to like working at Bell Labs and working on some early hardware, but also in conjunction with that, creating algorithmic music. So she's got several albums that she's recorded of algorithm based musical things, and LPs and things, and you can download a lot of them or you can buy them. A lot of them are maybe difficult to find on the original media because they were, you know, sort of niche back then, even in the 60s and 70s, but you can still find a lot of things on the internet. But what really interested me specifically was the Mac version of her algorithm music generator, for lack of a better term, called Music Mouse. It is an intelligent musical instrument for Mac, and that goes up to OS 9. It was originally came out on for like System 6 and early black and white Macs, but it has a funky interface, comes out of or spits out music either live or recorded, you know, into files, but as MIDI, and it's like still a thing that you can download if you have a vintage Mac. So I'll definitely check that out. I have not had a chance yet to actually try creating anything. Otherwise, I might have a sample to play. But I get the feeling that my control of a music algorithm is probably going to be about the same as my control of a musical instrument. So right. I would not want to subject that to you. But yeah, it's 1985 originally. Yeah, wrote the first program on a Mac 5 12K. So that's how far back it goes. But there's a So there's also Amiga and Atari ST versions that you can request. So if you have it running on Atari, or if you have an Atari, you can run it on that. I mean, it's like pretty cool music generation algorithmic stuff. Just kind of fascinates me that, you know, you can make something that sounds a little bit like Beethoven if you put in the right inputs. But what's also really cool is that she's still hosting this. She's still out there giving away the software for, I guess, for nothing, but yeah.
Cool.
Very cool.
Yeah, I had not come across that. When you mentioned that before, it reminded me at least of this Look Around You episode in which they designed the song Little Mouse. So anyone who's listening to that who doesn't know what I'm talking about, go find that and listen to it or watch it. This is maybe a little bit out of order, but the reason that was in the show notes as like a thing for 1951 was that one of the things that happened in 1951 was that the Franti Mark I computer was used to make computer music. So this was a kind of a first. It was a thing that, you know, some engineers, you know, stayed up all night and made the thing play God Save the Queen or some sort of thing. This is basically the computer that Alan Turing was working with. So there's a little article that talks about that, and actually somewhat there was a recording made in 1951 of this event, and it's kind of interesting to listen to. You can hear people sort of like laughing when it gets through a few notes and then crashes and whatever. But there was a restoration of that recording, because it turned out that the recording was it needed restoration. Like, it turned out that the speed wasn't quite right, you know, so if you listen to it unrestored, it's playing notes that they knew the thing couldn't play, you know, like there's only certain things it was able to do. Because it has the Franti had a capacity to produce an instruction called a hoot, which produced a short burst of sound lasting a fraction of a second.
It actually was sound coming out of a speaker and not like tuned in on an AM radio
right,
or something.
Right. It was it was made using this hoot instruction.
As an Apple II user, I will not judge its limitations.
Yeah, well, I was going to say it's exactly it's the same thing. It's the same way that Apple II makes noise too. You can make the thing click. That is all you can do.
Yep.
But that's not even a hoot. I mean, come on, that's a click, a hoot.
I don't know.
A hoot trumps a click any day.
But and I actually don't know what the basic sound sounds like. Although the music that came out of it, you know, sounded pretty reasonable. So it didn't sound to me like it was made of hoots.
Well, it's the same thing with the Apple II. Yeah. You get stuff and it doesn't sound like it's made of clicks. It's just you're varying its speed and suddenly it sounds like a continuous tone.
Yeah. And it may just be that the instruction was, the mnemonic for it was four characters long and the best they could do was come up with hoot.
Yeah, it could be. Anyway, it's also pretty interesting to read the stuff about, actually how it was restored, trying to figure out like what things it could do and matching that to the sounds that they got on the recording, because the recording speed varied. And so, to try to record, that's fine for speech. But what you're trying to do is record music, you don't want your, speed varying as you record.
Although maybe we're wrong. Maybe this whole thing was like a Mechanical Turk thing, and inside was just a person squeezing an owl.
That's right.
It's a big computer. There might be room inside of it for us.
Yes, right. For several people with several owls. Of varying sizes, of course,
different pitches.
Work out.
It's an owl delay line.
I think so.
It just needs more owls. It's like, oh no, project lead has lost it.
Yes. Yes, how does it go? I have a fever. My only prescription is more owls. Okay, anyway, so I guess that is 1951 covered.
That was it. That's all that happened.
Yep.
Done.
Yep. I'll also talk a little bit about some of the feedback that came in. I have not organized all of the stuff that came in, but Sean wrote in to point out that there is a full-length Commodore 64 training tape by Jim Butterfield that is available. It's actually a videotape. And is this Carrington? Is this somebody you know?
I do know from. Watching this in Canada.
Yeah, because he's a sort of a, like a Toronto person, Canadian.
Right. I'm like, hold on, what
is presenter?
This? Yeah, this would have been on TV Ontario.
Yeah, and I'm not sure if this actual tape was there, but I mean, like, he's a personality that was also on sort of Canadian TV in Toronto, but he's also pretty associated with Commodore and the Pet Users Group and stuff like that.
No, that is a mustache. That is a full-length Commodore 64 mustache.
That's right. But anyway, so it's 2 hours of Commodore goodness. I forgot if I said, but Sean wrote in to alert us to this and figured that Carrington, you would be the most receptive to this.
Yep, totally.
Now, was he a presenter on Canadian public TV back in the day?
He would have been on Bits and Bytes, definitely, but wasn't one of the main people. What I'm saying is he's not Lupagoy, because nobody is.
Right.
There was a TV show called The Academy, which I think was the one that he was the computer guy, like the main person, The Academy. And so, but he would I remember him being on Bits and Bytes as well.
There's the resident expert on the TV Ontario educational series, The Academy.
No. So. See, I know what I'm talking about. This is my childhood. All of us in Ontario, if you're a my age plus or minus 10 years, you would have grown up watching TV Ontario stuff. We all did. Mm-hmm. Computer things, but also tons of TV shows. We have this shared youth culture based around Canadian kids' TV shows. Like read all about it and stuff. And all wonderful things.
Excellent. All right. So that's excellent. If you're looking for, 2 hours of Commodore training, here is where you can start.
I am not.
Okay. Garrett wrote, so last time we talked a little bit about Animal, because there are Animals, I think it's called, on the Apple II System Master Disk, which is basically it's a kind of a program that learns, it's a 20 questions kind of thing where like you're thinking of an animal and the computer asks you a question and you say, you know, yes, it is the thing you're, you know, you answer the question and basically narrows down through binary choices, like what animal it is. Garrett wrote to talk about the history of animal. He said it, he thinks it was published first in David Ahl's Basic Computer Games book. And
that's timely.
Yes, I will just put up your screen because it happens to be there.
Say, I have that shared for something coming up. That's so funny.
But anyway, yeah. So apparently it was in that that book. And it was originally developed by Arthur Lerman at Dartmouth and subsequently shortened and modified by Nathan Teicholz at DEC and Steve North at Creative Computing. So it has a long history, in other words. I think Earl was saying that he wanted to see the source code. It is represented in various places.
Well, Dartmouth is where BASIC originated.
Yeah.
So it would not be surprising if some of the earliest programs to demonstrate it came from their their publications. Yeah.
And I guess the last bit of feedback was Sean sent a link to a Ricardo site, which I think is like a Swiss auction site. I'm not sure. .ch, that's Switzerland, right?
Well, the language on the site is German.
Right.
Which could be Swiss. Yeah.
.ch is Switzerland.
But anyway, to the 3D construction kit, which is I guess it's a ZX Spectrum program, but it is also a SAM Coupe compatible. So.
Oh, sure it is. Whatever.
Anyway, so just in case you're looking for a 3D construction set.
Believe how many people are still trying to push this whole idea that the SAM Coupe was a real computer.
Now, what year was that 3D construction set
from? That is a good question.
Because it says build your own virtual reality, which is would have been a very early use of that term.
1991.
Oh, well, never mind.
So, so when was the Lawnmower Man? Seems like about the same time, right?
I don't know. I put it out of my memory. I have repressed that memory.
Right. You didn't refresh your cathode ray tube, and it's gone.
Intentionally.
Anyway, okay. That's enough of the feedback for now. But others have sent in feedback, and we will get to it in future episodes, I am sure. But now I guess we can move to the items of interest, where Carrington wants to talk about the Basic Computer Games book.
I don't know if you've heard of this book called Basic Computer Games. You may have heard of it a few minutes ago. So very famous book. A lot of people listening to this podcast probably grew up, or at least if you didn't have the book, you would have known this sort of book. So it's a book of type-in games for microcomputers. I had it. A lot of people had it. It's one of those things where if you're interested in early computers, it's how you would learn to do games and such. And one of the ideas behind BASIC and these books in particular was like training people how to program. Hey, you don't know how to program. Here's a language supposedly, or at least ostensibly, for learning to program. B stands for beginner. And here are some games and some things you could type in so you get to understand the concepts. Here's a way to become a programmer. And so some people, and I don't necessarily agree with any of this, but I'm on the fence. Maybe. Like, I don't know. I used to think this is all true, and now I'm waffling. But you can't really do that nowadays. Like, how would you tell somebody, like, learn to program, here's a basic guide? Like, what's that's not a thing anymore. But there's a very interesting something interesting happening over on GitHub where interesting things happen. And a bunch of people have gotten together, and they're recreating all the stuff from this book in a bunch of other languages. So if you want to learn Ruby or Python or Visual Basic or C or whatever, here are all these games redone in those languages. So for instance, like here's the list. We're looking at the GitHub repository right now. Mm-hmm. If I click on Animal, the third one. So here are you can see Animal in C#, Java, JavaScript, like all these languages. Learn it in Pascal, learn it in Perl. So it's like if you want to learn programming, you want to approach a new language or something. And so it says, well, maybe there is something to that. Maybe these sorts of programs, just to type in and then run, are a good gateway drug to programming. But people don't really have access to BASIC much anymore. So But it's very easy to find access to something like Ruby or Perl or Python or PHP or whatever. And so people are just recreating all these programs in those languages. And I thought it was what a fascinating project. How interesting. So you might want to contribute because there's some of these have more of the languages completed than others. So just pick one of the games and, you know, port it to the language of your choice and you can upload it to this so you can join in the fun. I love it. I love everything about this. I think this is very cool. That's
very
it. Cool.
Very nice. Yes.
Yeah.
You know, I have a copy of that book. I don't think I had it back in the relevant day, but I really have not yet done anything more than sort of flip through it. But there were sort of similar books at least that I've got some experience with.
And I think everybody would know books like this sort of thing, but this was one of the more famous ones. And I just love it. What a fantastic idea. So there's currently 160 contributors to it. It's catching some of the interest. It's becoming a zeitgeist, I tell you. It's gonna be awesome. So
yeah, there's a similar, and it may be in, I'm not sure if it's hosted on GitHub or if it's on like a media wiki of its own, but it's like basically a collection of Hello World in every computer language. And there's a similar sort of thing where it's, you know, if you want to display a bouncing ball on your screen, here's 50 different computer languages and examples from, you know, from authors that are experts in those languages to do a bouncing ball in Python or, you know, in COBOL or whatever. Not that most of those have, you know, graphical things, but the sheer number of ways to do Hello World and how long and complicated some of them are, it's fascinating to me.
there's actually a little bit, a link that you didn't talk about, I think, in the music section, did you?
Yes, with the on that site from Laurie Spiegel is the one of the things that she was involved in was the Alpha Centauri music synthesizer on the Apple II, which is probably going to be relevant to more of our audience than some of the other stuff on the Mac, because, you know, Apple II.
One thing that's cool about that, just to mention, is that because you can't hear it necessarily, but Centauri is it's SYN as in like synthesizer, Alpha Centauri.
Yes, it's a great audio pun. But the other thing that I wanted to add into the show notes that I'm going to surprise you, I'm going to shock and amaze you by putting it into the show notes last minute is the Million Perfect Letters game by 4AM. Have you guys talked about that on the show before?
I don't think we have done that. No.
Yeah. Yes, he's been crafting a number of word and letter based. Games, I think partly as an excuse to design more screen fonts for the Apple II. Hmm. But it's hosted on archive.org, or you can, you know, follow the development of on Twitter. His handle is A2_4AM. But the there are similar games whose names are escaping me now, but it's it's a field of letters where you sort of slide the columns up and down until horizontally the letters form a word, and then once you've used up all the letters in the columns, then you've finished that level, and then, you know, continually gets harder and harder. So like a 3x3 you can do, you know, really quickly, but some of the demos and things go up to like 7 letters and 7 words by 7 letters is, you know, it takes you quite some time. But yeah, it's a fascinating fun little game that you can kind of lose yourself in for a long period of time. I know I have. And I helped do some of the early game testing, play testing. But my contribution to it mainly was finding all the bad words
yep.
that you could form by moving things around. So I'm probably the inspiration of several bad word finding algorithms or scripts or whatever it is that he has to run all of his word combinations through before they go into the game. So you're welcome.
Very cool. Okay, so the thing I am going to talk about is Deathlord Relorded. I actually also have
the original Deathlord nice.
Game here too. But anyway, so what Deathlord is a when is it from? Does it say? probably 1987, something like that. But anyway, it's a game that I think was on the Commodore 64 and Apple II. It was kind of Ultima inspired. It has sort of an Ultima feel to it. So you're walking around a little, you know, like a little tile map, and you're interacting with people and stuff like that. And so what the project is that I'm linking to here is basically it's taken Deathlord, which, you know, part of the concept here is that Deathlord kind of people missed it somehow. Like it's better than it has gotten credit for in a sense. And there was a couple of reasons for that were given here. One of them had to do with sort of like last second changes to make it kind of like Japanese localized in a way that wound up making it very confusing, because in a lot of the character classes wound up being in Japanese, which wound up like not actually being very useful. Like you have to know what the Japanese word is for assassin in order to understand that you have made your character an assassin or a thief.
Wait,
or whatever.
What do I do for a living? Oh no.
But anyway, so what this project is basically taking that game, which, you know, the author Rickles is what I see it listed as. And so on itch.io, there is a way that you can download it. It's a Windows 10 program, but what it is basically an emulator that latches on to the actual Deathlord program and provides like a modern skin for it. So what's weird about this is that it is not rewritten. It is running the actual Deathlord program from 1980 whatever. But it is projecting, you know, sort of looking into the memory and seeing what things are and projecting out, like much better rendered graphics and bigger screens. Cool. And all that stuff. So it really is, you know, it looks like a modern game, but all the brains and all the interactions and all the, you know, non-player characters and stuff are being driven by 6502 code, you know, written in the 80s.
That is really cool.
Yeah.
That is cool.
There's lots of games that I would love to see that done to.
Did you ever play Deathlord, Charles?
I never did. I never played any of the Ultima games for more than a few sessions. They didn't really grab me the way the, say, Bard's Tale did. Mm-hmm. Similar concept in that it's an RPG, but I think the depth of what you could do in the dungeons versus in the sort of overworld map and everything kind of threw me, and I was like, I'll stick to text adventures and then a few of the graphical RPGs.
I never even heard of Deathlord when I was a kid. I missed it when it came out. It completely passed me by. I never even heard about it. Later on, I did hear about it, but it didn't appeal to me because I either read or completely misunderstood. I thought it was a game more like a real-time strategy game where you were controlling huge armies of people or something. And I'm just not interested in that kind of game. So who knew? Maybe I would actually like this. I think I might actually like this.
Yeah. I have not tried it. It does require Windows 10, and that stopped me.
I'd probably just play the original one. I'd play the Apple II version.
Yeah. Well, actually, and one thing you can do in here is if you want to, you can, you know, turn off the modern thing and just like look at the Apple II version of what you're doing at that moment. And then, you know, you can sort of switch back and forth. You know,
it'd be more fun to not know if I'm an assassin. Maybe I'm, maybe I'm a farmer. Who knows what I am? Let's go into this dungeon and see what happens.
Yeah.
I'm going to fork this project and make a version called Am I an Assassin? You don't know until you try to kill somebody. It goes, no, you instead farm a crop.
It's like, what is it, Werewolf, the game? He's like, are you the werewolf? Are you the assassin? Oh, you're the assassin.
He's the assassin. I'm the assassin. We're all going to close our eyes, and if you are an assassin, I want you to put your hand up.
Maybe that relates also to this. There's another electronic arts game I have called something like, you know, How to Host a Murder Party or something.
Right.
Also similar. In that one, you are the assassin. Someone is, at least.
But someone has to be the victim.
It's true. Yeah, so it's a very cool choice of name, Deathlord Reloaded.
Yeah.
That's great. It's also just an interesting concept. It's
like, what a fascinating approach. I can't remember another project that took that approach.
Yeah.
That's great.
It reminds me a little bit in a very tangential way to a thing that I did back when, you know, I don't know when this must have been, like the early 90s or something, when there weren't all that many Apple II emulators. There was one that was called Stop the Madness, and it worked on the Mac. Yeah. And it had a little screen, and, you know, it did pretty well. You know, it ran Apple II stuff. But one thing it didn't do was save. You know, so like you could write a little basic program and save it on a disk image, and then when you quit, the disk image was gone, and everything, all your work was lost. And so I wrote a little sidecar program that would sit, you know, sort of next to Stop the Madness, and it would investigate the memory within Stop the Madness. And when you wanted to save the image, it would grab the disk image out of the place where it was stored inside the memory that was allocated to Stop the Madness and save it. So in a sense, it was really sort of like an outside monitor, you know, grabbing stuff. And that's sort of what this is doing. It's kind of like it's letting the Apple II run and do its own little thing, but it's watching what it's doing, and it's projecting a much nicer sort of environment. So
one thing that I had considered, it's on my, you know, my list of ideas that I have not yet gotten to, is a you mentioned like sort of a sidecar or an external monitor program, but something that does that same sort of thing with a modern Apple II emulator, but gives it like a screen reading capability. So you could be, you know, you're playing your Apple II game or whatever, and this whatever shell or whatever that's around it would be able to do things like read the text on the screen, or give you audio clues of like if your joystick is over, or your, you know, your cursor is over a thing. It's like, what color is this? What hex, you know, hex code or whatever. But even just the idea of, you know, you fire up Pitch Dark or whatever, and have the emulator speak to you what the text adventure is showing you would make things a lot more accessible for, you know, visually impaired people.
It's not super trivial, you know, as an exercise, because, you know, really it's just a bunch of dots on the screen. You know, like it really does have to be something kind of like a character recognizer or something.
Or be able to read this, you know, the portion of memory that actually represents the text screen for a text-only game, but then also know when it refreshes and how much it refreshes, so it's not reading you the whole screen.
Yeah.
And then there's, you know, there's places where the, you know, the screen gets split, and then there's like the menu bar, you know, the title bars and things like that. So it's, yeah, it's not completely trivial, but it would be an interesting, you know, maybe a hack fest or something to try and have that, have a crack at it.
Yep. All right. Cool. What else? Oh, I'm the only one that has any other things here.
It's all you, Paul.
I switched the order, and then it didn't matter. I came across this. I think Jason Scott tweeted something about it or something. I forget exactly how this came across my radar, but it's about the text adventure game called The Hobbit. And so there's, I think we talked a little bit about this IF-50 project.
Which is so good. That project is so amazing. So for people who don't know, it's a series of articles about big moments in interactive fiction, basically big game. Oh, it's so good. They're all fantastic.
And I think there are a number of articles that we intended to talk about but have yet to get back to. But this one was about the Hobbit, which is, you know, it's a J.R.R. Tolkien inspired thing. There's a Australian publishing house. I think it's Melbourne House or something. Let me actually go. I'll go to the Digital Antiquarian story about this, which, you know, also sort of talks about the same thing. Here we go. Melbourne House it basically wanted to sort of get on the bandwagon here of like publishing computer games and interactive fiction and stuff. And so they hired, I think it was a couple of undergraduates, basically, to kind of like, first of all, they got permission to use Tolkien's work and then handed it off to the...
Which is surprising that they even asked. Most people would have just said, oh, we're going to write something and throw a bunch of hobbits and elves in it and not even bother.
Yeah. But so, I mean, essentially what they were aiming to do was to, you know, really make this like the best interactive fiction thing, you know, game that you could make. And so one thing they definitely wanted to get away from was the two-word parser and stuff like that. So, you know, it's supposed to be very sort of linguistically sophisticated. And another thing that they also wanted to do was give the non-player characters personalities, you know, so they would do things kind of like, you know, they would have a sort of range of things they would do. It wouldn't be the same thing every time, you know. So it gave a certain replayability to it as well. So it really was, it wasn't just a series of like puzzles with, you know, sort of like a facade of some story around them. It actually was really trying to get into the characters and, you know, make them behave in a way that's sort of familiar to people who know the books. The bottom line of this was just that, it turned out that, it was a terrible game. because a lot of times these characters would like they would go do something in a place where you weren't, that would make the game unwinnable. You know, so the characters would fail to pick something up or whatever. You know, like they'd fumble something when they were trying to get something, and then something you would need them to have later they don't.
Or they die or whatever. It was an interesting concept, though, having the characters be able to basically move around their own volition. That if you're like one of the examples I've been given in the stuff you're linking to says you could be trapped in a cell, and one way you might be able to get out of it is instead of like trying to find a key or whatever, if Gandalf is on the other side of the one wall, or you can shout to him, Gandalf, like, go north, go east, take the key, open the door. Uh-huh. And then you wait a few turns. And it could be that Gandalf then opens the door, or it could be that Gandalf gets killed carrying out what you thought, and you're now just too bad. You'll wait forever. You killed Gandalf. Or it could be, and like, it's just because they're just moving, and something else can happen. And that's such an interesting, like, advanced concept for a very early text adventure, like a two-word parser text adventure game.
Yeah, and it was also pretty impressive. You know, it also did this algorithmic drawing of pictures and stuff so that you can fit, because this had to fit on a cassette tape. They had to be able to render all these rooms and the graphics for them in not very many bytes. And so the best way to compress that is basically to not compress the image, but just compress the instructions that, you know, it used to draw the image. So draw a line from here to here rather than remembering the pixels.
Yeah, a bit like the Mystery House. Yes,
we talked a couple of episodes ago. Yeah, about Sierra, and that idea, like coming up with that, is covered in that horrible, horrible book that I gave a glowing review to for about what's his name, Roberta Williams' husband.
Yeah, who knows?
Ken Williams and his book of awfulness. That book, it's like it stained me. But he talks about this in that book, like this brilliant idea he came up with that no one had ever come up with before, and it was the best thing ever. And Roberta was lucky to have him do it for her, because she wouldn't have been able to finish the game without him. How are you still married, dude? It's unreal.
Anyway, yeah, so I think the Hobbit game is just sort of a funny thing, you know, that it basically got released. It was a big intellectual property given to a couple of people with overambitious ideas, and you wound up with these things, you know, like there's a quote here, somebody talking about, you know, in one game I played, Gandalf had the odd habit of picking up dead bodies and walking around with them.
Well, in the article, it talks about how the lead programmer that had responded to the job ad, essentially, on on the campus, had only ever played one adventure game, said like it played a bit of adventure and mapped out the maze. And as soon as it's done, said, I'm bored. Like, hey, Adol John, don't want anything to do with this. And this was the person put in charge of doing this. And it's like, oh, adventure games are boring. It would be so awful to have a static map and just puzzles. Who would want that? I'm going to make this exciting, dynamic thing. But I think it was a fundamental misunderstanding of what people want from these games when you have somebody making one who hates the genre.
Right.
It's ahead of its time for the idea of an open world, you know, anything can happen kind of game.
I've never played it either, and I love text adventures and adventure games of all sorts. So, it's on my list.
You're warned. Yeah,
I'm
warned by a group.
I had already heard it was pretty terrible, but I want to play it anyway. I want to play them all.
Yeah, you can certainly play it on archive.org. In the Spectrum version, and you can buy it on eBay if you want. It comes in a sort of a nice looking box. There's two different boxes. I assume all the problems are still there, you know. But
I want to include this one included a copy of The Hobbit, the book. So the game came with a copy of The Hobbit. Oh, interesting.
Right.
Not that it would help you with the game.
Maybe you needed. Maybe it was turn to page 1704. What does Smaug say? It's the first line.
Right.
Smaug. Sorry, yeah. Tolkien people, don't email me.
Yeah, or it's like Hitchhiker's Guide, where if you've actually read the book, it is actively discouraged. Does not help you at all with the game.
Right. I like that game.
I do too. But
see the Eat My Group episode in which Charles was on it.
Yeah, oh. It's so different from each of the iterations of the Hitchhiker's Guide in different media are so different from the previous that, you know, knowing one would not help you with playing the game at all.
They did what number years anniversary edition on the, I think it was like the BBC site or whatever, had a kind of a nice little interactive way that you could play it. And it warned you, like, basically, you know, this game will kill you often.
It's the only way you can learn.
Yep. Which is, and it is actually funny, fairly funny that it lets you continue interacting with it, you know, even after your character has died. It just admonishes you for, like, you know, trying to be so active while you're dead. Okay. I think that is actually the end of the items of interest and news that we had. And now, a word from our sponsor.
Morning, kids. It's a Pac-Man day with my crispy corn cereal coming your way.
With marshmallows.
Delicious. I'm Pinky.
I'm Blinky.
I'm Pinky.
I'm Clyde.
With the marshmallows, you'll find inside.
There goes a Pac-Pac.
Oh. And Pinky, too.
Oh. He's marshmallow. You can chomp him, too.
It's Pac-Man.
Part of this nutritious breakfast.
It's Pac-Man.
With marshmallows.
These are days of mechanical and electronic marvels. The Massachusetts Institute of Technology has developed a new one for the Navy. It's a whirlwind electronic computer. With considerable trepidation, we undertake to interview this new machine. Now to MIT and the computer lab at Cambridge, Massachusetts. Well, I wonder if we could take a look around, sir.
Yes. Let's first look at one of the storage tubes, such as the Whirlwind uses for memory. Whirlwind stores in these tubes information in 25 millionths of a second. And further down the row, you can see some of the electronic circuits which make Whirlwind work. Would you like to try to use the machine?
Yes, of course, but I have an idea, Mr. Forrester. Since this computer was made in conjunction with the Office of Naval Research, why don't we switch down to the Pentagon in Washington and let the Navy's research chief, Admiral Bolster, give Whirlwind the workout. What's your problem, Admiral?
Well, Ed, this problem concerns the Navy's Viking rocket. This rocket goes up 135 miles into the sky. Now, at the standard rate of fuel consumption, I would like to see the computer trace the flight path of this rocket and see how it can determine at any instant, say at the end of 40 seconds, the amount of fuel remaining.
Then as the rocket starts down, velocity picks up again for the maximum velocity when the rocket hits the ground.
How's that?
Well, how about that, Admiral?
Looks very good to me.
Well, sir, I'm just a middleman here. I didn't understand the question, and I don't understand the answer. But now let's go back to MIT for a moment. Are you there, Mr. Foster?
Yes, Mr. Morrow. And before leaving, we would like to show you another kind of mathematical problem that some of the boys have worked out in their spare time in a less serious vein for Sunday afternoon.
Thank you very much indeed, Mr. Foster, and the MIT lab.
And we're back. Okay, so the host's retro computing gift idea this time is it's on Etsy, and it is a little set of really quite nice little wooden coasters that are in the shape of 3.5-inch discs. So you can get them in various different colors: gunstock gray, espresso, dark walnut, barn red, teal. You can actually also get personalized text written on them if you want. I think that's pretty cool. But actually, the real thing that I think is cool about this is that you can pair that with, from the same seller, a little disc box to hold them in. On the back, it actually has like a, you know, little serial and power things stenciled onto it. But it looks like a little disc drive that you can put these coasters
into. It's delightful. I love it.
That is amazing. That's amazing.
Yeah, it's the storage box. Like, instead of just having the stack of coasters out, having that little box and be able to say, oh, here are my coasters. It's great. It has a little eject button on the front, which doesn't actually work. You can actually eject the coasters,
disappointing.
Unfortunately. But it's still pretty cool. I like it.
Do the little metal slidey bits actually slide, or are they just static?
I don't think they're actually metal. However, it is about the coolest looking thing I've seen for a long time. So
yeah. And the price is in Canadian dollars.
That's right. So it's,
for some reason, Etsy keeps doing that to Paul.
That's right. So $48 will at least buy this. I don't know what the shipping would be, but depends on where you are, I assume.
I just love it, though. What a great set of coasters. A big fan of this choice.
Yeah.
So, Paul, do you see the thing that I'm sharing?
I do. I think I do.
Yes. So that was a suggestion that I had for a retro computing gift idea. Unfortunately, it's a one-off, so someone just made one. But I think if we ask around, if we share widely enough, there will be someone that can make this.
What?
As
I just got what this
product.
Is.
Yeah. So for those who are only listening and not actually watching this on the stream, it is it's basically like a humidifier, right? It's like a mister for the air.
It's an air freshener, you know.
So you can imagine out of the top of it, you see a mist of what looks like smoke. That's important.
It's
part to
a cylinder, cylinder shape. And I think somebody, so from what I understood about the history of this thing, someone had, made something like this that was shaped like a cup noodles thing, you know. So it was sort of possible in Japan to get a little cup noodles thing that was, you know, it looked like a cup noodles thing, but would sort of like the steam coming out of it would be the misting. And so this person saw that this was sort of a similar shape to a capacitor.
Yeah,
so it's basically like capacitor. A cap blowing its top, putting out the smell, releasing the magic smoke.
Yeah.
Hilarious.
It looks very, very funny.
And based on the scale, it doesn't have, you know, a banana, but the bottles and such in the background of the video that's looping, it looks like it's about, you know, maybe 8 or 10 inches tall. It's a giant capacitor. Like I want one. If there's an Etsy store or someone who is looking for projects to sell to electronics enthusiasts, take notes and then take my money.
Somewhere I did find the initial, you know, the person who actually made it. And there's a sort of a follow-up video and pictures of sort of like the construction of this thing and stuff. So if that were ever made into something that someone could get many of, then that will definitely be a gift idea for several future episodes. Now that we're done with all of the gifting, we can move on to the hard capitalism of eBay. And Carrington, I guess you have the first things in this category.
I do indeed.
Is it really that hard?
It's very, very difficult. So my first item I thought was interesting and topical because we're talking about these 1950s computers. This is a Remington Rand Univac Industrial Computers Vintage Sales Advertising Book. The title calls it a salesman's advertising book, and I thought, oh, it's, you know, from the period, it's all sexist. And the book doesn't say that. That's just the wording from the lister. Come on, man. Really? But whatever. But this is really cool. So if you are walking around trying to sell a Univac computer at the time, this is the brochure you would have and you would be handing out. How neat is that? So it's all about the Univac and what it can do and why it's awesome. Look at that magnetic media or magnetic memory. We all know where that really came from. So this is just, it's so interesting. Like, this is a period brochure for selling a Univac. How cool. Less cool is it's $625. So that's very expensive brochure. It's a buy it now. You can make an offer. I offer $5. But I thought it was really neat. So is it worth buying? Is it worth just looking at? Certainly worth looking at. Nice big, big photos. You can easily read what it says. So I recommend looking at the listing, but not necessarily pulling the trigger. But I thought it was cool. So if you ever dreamed of being a big iron salesperson, this is the brochure for you.
Or even just a small iron salesperson.
Right. Or a small, big iron salesperson or whatever.
Yes. There are no small parts, just small actors.
There are no small computers.
Yeah. So has do you know if the brochure itself has been scanned? I mean,
the photos
are pretty high resolution.
Yeah.
But
no idea. But I'm not willing to pull the trigger on it to scan it. So
yeah. And people might recognize the style of that from the photo that was used as sort of like the background for this podcast. It was stolen directly from a "You're Trying to Divide by Zero" UNIVAC ad. Yep. But I mean, that brochure looks very much like this.
Yep.
for good reason.
So that's my first choice. Don't actually recommend buying it, but I do recommend looking at it because I found it very, very fascinating. Second choice is a thing called CodeWriter. I've seen this a few times, and I was never sure what it was, and I finally looked into it. And I'm really just picking it because I finally know what the heck the thing is. So it's the Plain English Program Design System, and I always wondered what that meant. And it is like we talked about before with the 100 Basic Games, the idea that, like, hey, you're not a programmer, but you want to become one or whatever. So this is in the realm of those things. This was something where you could create a program for your microcomputer, but not needing to be a programmer. It creates the basic code for you. You design your layout. It's mostly for doing things like that would be database run or form processing. So you draw it out, you design your layout and say if something's put in here, then multiply it by the number that's put out there. And then you can create your little front end system with a little database running it. And it spits out the basic code to actually do that. And you design it all in plain English. So you'll say just multiply the field from whatever by the field. And so you just type in English and it creates basic code. And I found that interesting. Like I've always been very fascinated by these ideas that people make to say, okay, you're not a programmer, we'll make it regular English. And almost always that's a terrible idea, because if you're not a programmer, you're not going to have the logic to do it anyway. And I find those things often more difficult. I remember working in not AppleSoft, what's the scripting language? AppleScript. And all the time going,
AppleScript,
okay,
yeah.
What is the preposition you want me to use? And it's so much easier if I could just write this in a coding language. So I struggle with plain English text things. But I find this. So this is $29. It had been listed previously for $39. This is a relisting. It's only got 2 hours and 7 minutes left as of this recording. So it means it'll probably be gone by the time you listen to the show. But if it gets relisted again, maybe it'll be $19. So it keeps getting cheaper. Unfortunately for me, $82 international shipping. So yeah, watch the shipping cost when you look at it if you're not near this thing, because it's in where? Colorado. Come on, $82? Must be driving it to me. In plain English, I say no. But I'm fascinated by these sorts of things. So this is CodeWriter. The reason I'm picking that is I read about it to figure out what is this thing, and that's how I learned about Adventure Writer and the ELF system and such. And so I'm also going to have a link in the show notes. So CodeWriter, the company, also published Adventure Writer, which I think was actually by somebody else, and CodeWriter is just a publisher in certain countries for it or what have you. And so Adventure Writer was a similar sort of thing where it's like, hey, you're going to create adventure games, but the idea was it's, I guess, database driven. So you create a database and that database then spits out a two-word parser adventure game. Is that right, Paul? Like that's kind of what I was getting from this article.
I think so, yeah. I mean, all I was going to say about it was that they also made Adventure Writer, and I have a picture of it sitting on my chair, but I don't have it handy. So
okay, well, so the Adventure Writer, which I didn't know about, and I'm so interested in, and currently working on a text adventure game. So I'm fascinated in all these systems, and Adventure Writer was published as a system, and also then they published games. You would get these ready to play games, and there'd be like two or three games in the package that were created with the Adventure Writer system. I don't know if you create a game in Adventure Writer, if you can publish it as a standalone thing, or somebody has to own Adventure Writer to run. I don't know if it compiles or not, but I'm interested in Adventure Writer. But looking up and reading about Adventure Writer then led me to the Quill, which is like another version of that from the same people, but I think the better version or something, or a later version. But that led me to Gilsoft. Gilsoft, the Welsh Wizards of Adventure. Now, I am very interested in everything by Gilsoft now because they're the Welsh Wizards of Adventure. I was unaware of Gilsoft, but they were the publishers or maybe even creators of Adventure Writer for the Spectrum and the Commodore 64. And I think it's Gilsoft who made it, and then it was published by CodeWriter. I think that's the way they went. Anyway, the fact that Gilsoft is the Welsh Wizards of Adventure makes me now their new biggest fan. I do want to get a Welsh Wizards of Adventure bag to make Welsh friends. And I'm fascinated now, and I'm going to be doing a deep dive into Gilsoft and Adventure Writer and all of this, because all this is new to me and I'm fascinated. But the Welsh Wizards of Adventure, come on, that's great. So I'm fascinated by all of this. And all of this is to say you can currently buy CodeWriter for $29 on eBay. And it just led me down this rabbit hole reading about Adventure Writer, which led me reading about the Quill, which led me to Killsoft. And I learned that they were the Welsh Wizards of Adventure, and my life is now better for it.
The comment about AppleScript, it's designed to be a human-readable programming language, but unfortunately it's not very human-writable.
Right.
So that's been around for a long time, the idea of I want to write as if I were just telling the computer what to do, or like you would like these days you would say, hey, insert name brand voice activated thing here so that it doesn't actually activate, do this thing for me, and it just would do it, so it understands the context of what you're saying. So the idea of writing, there's a wizard, and if you attack him, he has this many hit points, and this, you know, will cast these spells at you, and then suddenly, brrr, you know, you have a parser that's generated for you specific to your every whim. I think that's great. I think
That's what informs 7. That's what it is. Or Inform 6, which I've been coding in Puny Inform, which is a subset of Inform 6, is more like, you know, a language, a computer programming language, versus whereas Inform 7 is very English readable. That's the difference with it.
Yeah. That's kind of where I was thinking, was like, is the interpreter for the language that you're writing your commands in smart enough to understand what you're writing, so that eventually the parser that you are playing the game in is therefore intelligent enough to understand what you're writing in the parser. It's like it's parsers all the way down. It's like a parser inception in text adventure form. But yeah, I'd love to see what Gilsoft, the Welsh Wizards of Adventure, what language, what the Quill language actually looks like.
I hope that it ends up that at the bottom it's logo, you know, so that it really is like parses all the way down until you get to a turtle.
It's drawing the letters, pen down, make the shape of a G, and it's remarkably slow but very cool.
I'm just afraid of it being based on Welsh. It's going to be all consonants.
Yeah, several of them L's twice.
So that's what I got.
Cool. Yeah. Yeah. Somewhere there's a 4 a.m. crack of Event Writer, I think. That one can try it in. And if I can ever figure out which box I put that in after I took a photo of it on my chair, I can maybe try it out myself too. Okay, let's see. Charles, you have the next of the eBay auctions.
So my first auction, I've got a couple here. The first thing that came up when I logged into eBay to poke around at vintage things, see what was in my watch list, was... there's some anniversary of Pac-Man, the video game, this year. And so it was showing me a bunch of Pac-Man related things. So I started cycling through. And this, I think I probably would have bought back in the 80s if I had known about it. It is an area rug with the Pac-Man logo and the ghosts all over it, and a somewhat... sort of interpretation of the game board. The maze doesn't look quite right, and the ghosts on the game board don't look quite right. But even so, it's an area rug of the Pac-Man game that you could have on your floor, and you can, you know, play Pac-Man on the rug.
It's funny, around the outside border, it really just shows images of Pac-Man muscling his way around, beating up on the ghosts. It really makes Pac-Man look like the bad guy in this game. The ghosts are just poor put upon little things.
And it is true, actually. Yeah, they are all being oppressed by Pac-Man.
And they're all sad and right. Yeah. And it's weird, the quality of the graphics on the outside border are considerably better than the quality of the graphics inside. So it's a bit like the outside of the game box, and then you open it up and actually put it in the computer, and then the graphics are a little disappointing compared to what you saw on the artist interpretation on the game box.
And the image you're showing now, right above the rug, is that like a shoe or something? Like for scale, how big is this thing?
I think it's a pillow, but it's 4 feet by 3 feet. So it's a beach towel size.
Huh. I wonder what the anniversary is.
In metric, that's roughly 1 and a little bit meters by slightly less than 1 meter.
In hectares.
In hectares, yeah. But again, and then on the inside, like if you look at the game board, it's got dots, and then some of them are yellow, but they're not in the right places. And the ghosts
a lot of them are yellow. I can see what the ghosts are.
The ghosts are all in different orientations.
Well, I can see it because they don't want the rug to look only correct from one viewing standpoint. So I agree with that choice. Yeah.
But the walls are different thicknesses, and then the logo in the middle is diagonal and doesn't fit inside the box. That it's a mess of vintage Pac-Man goodness. So the second thing Pac-Man related. I'm just going to say I had this.
Oh, did you really?
This lunchbox and this thermos. I had the thermos for a lot longer than the lunchbox. I think on mine the handle broke, so I had the thermos in a different lunchbox. I remember having the Pac-Man thermos, and taking it, you know, carrying my lunch to school and every day. My initials are not DJ, so this is not my lunchbox, but it's you know, the pressed steel. Lunchbox with the plastic handle, and then it's got what is it, Dwayne A. Stair Jr. His name is sort of etched into the front of it, and
if you're listening
DJ,
now,
yeah.
Yep.
If you're listening, your lunchbox is on eBay.
Yep. And you can get it back for only $50.
We're taking your lunch money.
It's just a great, like. This is exactly what I carried to school when I was in elementary school to carry my lunch. And it's like, and it, you know, it even has like a this is where your thermos goes.
Yeah, oh, illustration.
I remember this.
Yeah.
Rob, fellow podcaster Rob O'Hara has a neat collection of vintage lunchboxes. Lunches boxes.
I feel like I should go through and get some of the ones that I remember having. Like I think I had, I know I had Pac-Man, and I think I didn't have Dukes of Hazzard, but it, like I know that I had friends that did, because that was just like the thing that we all watched, and you know, it was in our imaginations.
One thing I was going to say about the lunchbox though is that it continues that same art, at least on the, not on the thermos so much, but on the box itself, it has that same theme as the rug art did, which is basically like Pac-Man oppressing the poor ghosts.
Pac-Man, a bully. They've even got his eyes like really close together, and so he looks like just... little menacing Pac-Man, poor ghosts.
Yeah, he looks kind of evil on the front.
This is ghost propaganda, is what this is.
Yeah. But I prefer the art on the sides, where it's much simpler and it's nicer artwork. This is sort of where the brand would eventually sort of go toward, as opposed to the, you know, Pac-Man doesn't have legs and arms, and his leg doesn't come out of his chin so much. It's a weird. Weird art style. But anyhow, finally, last thing Pac-Man related. This is the... this is a homemade button vintage from the 80s.
Also by Dwayne.
You know, I didn't check. Pac Teacher. And it's just... It looks like it's Xeroxed hand-drawn pencil artwork on brown paper of a teacher... in the shape of Pac-Man. It looks like she is yelling at a line of,
or she's about to gobble them all up.
Students,
I guess.
Yeah, either yelling or about to consume a line of dot-shaped students with frowny faces on. So this is the quarter for scale.
It's bigger than I thought.
This sort of a pin badge that you would get that you could make for the the machine, that the little pressing machine.
It's crazy the stuff that survives. Like 1,000 years from now, they're digging through the art of our society, and this will be one of the things. We've got the statue by Michelangelo. We've got the Pac Teacher handmade button. It's just a whole mishmash. What was their culture like?
So, $15.
I can actually sort of remember like the construction of these kinds of things, though. I mean, like there were services that you could, you know, you made the little thing, and then you submitted it, and then they got back this nice little button. Or
I had a friend who made buttons, one of those presses to make buttons.
Yeah, I was gonna say, you have it's like a machine roll press, and you buy like a bunch of little square pieces of plastic that go over top of it, and it crimps it around. Yeah.
Yeah.
But I just saw this, and I thought this is the best sort of off brand. Is the teacher yelling? Is she going to eat the kids? Is it celebrating PAC teacher? Is it saying be aware the teacher is going to eat you? I have questions. That's all I got to say.
Yeah, there. I was trying to figure out what I don't understand what it was. eBay is kind of behind the times, I think, in terms of like when the Pac-Man anniversary is, because it seems to me that like when I look this up, the anniversary was in 2020 of the 40th anniversary of Pac-Man. So
this is the anniversary of the first anniversary,
the second anniversary of the 40th anniversary of Pac-Man.
Still counts.
And I think on the 30th anniversary may have been when there was the Google Doodle that you could play as Pac-Man. Mm. Perhaps you remember
that
this.
That wasted so many hours of productivity across the globe.
That was pretty great.
Yeah, though. I'm trying to find the promo, but it was like, like I said, when I first logged in, it was like something to do with Pac-Man as the reason it was showing me all the Pac-Man related stuff, but I don't see it anymore because now I'm logged in and it's like, you're already here. You don't need the promo anymore.
Yeah. We've already sucked you in.
Yeah.
Okay.
What about you, Paul? What have you got?
I guess I have some things.
To share with the PAC class.
Okay. That's right. Here's the PAC teacher. Okay. So I don't know if I'll talk about all these. Maybe I will. Maybe I won't. This is a Motorola MEK6800 D2 microcomputer evaluation kit. And it's pretty cool. It basically, you know, it's kind of like development kit / trainer type thing for the 6800 chip. So it is, you know, it's what you would expect. It looks pretty complete. It looks pretty nice. It is a starting bid of $350. And this is at least the first relist, if not more than that. I mean, like, so it's not flying off the shelves. It does actually seem to me like it might be priced right too. But anyway, so the 6800 is the chip that the 6502 was trying to sort of like undercut, right? I mean, so the 6800 was it did a lot of the same stuff that the 6502 did, but was but the 6800 was expensive, and so the 6502 was largely, I think the 6501 was a drop-in replacement, if I'm not mistaken.
Yeah, that's what I was trying to remember, if it was a 6500 or a 6501 or whatever, but the previous iteration was literally pin compatible with the 68 with the Motorola 6800. And at some point, Motorola said, we're not going to sue you, but if you don't change this, we'll sue you, something along those lines. So they made they had to change it. And it was mostly still instruction level compatible at first, I think, but the signals on the actual chip had to change so that it couldn't be, you know, sold for half the price and then just drop in to the same logic boards.
Yeah, but this thing is actually pretty cool. So it's a kit, you know, and it basically, you know, it lets you construct a interface to this chip and let you play around with it. And I found that Wikipedia has a little description of this development board, but I also found a site where somebody had put up some pictures of the unbuilt kit. You know, so what this kit, how this kit looked before it was constructed, which is also kind of neat to see. It's probably very hard to find an unbuilt one, but it is kind of neat.
Now, it's got a card edge connector. Is that a S100 bus? Could you put it into a backplane?
I don't know. It's a good question. Does it have?
I don't know enough about S100 to see the. Yeah.
I can't count to 50, but looks like it could be 50, though. It's plausible.
I believe it.
I mean, it does seem like there must be some rationale for putting those card edges there. I mean, some of them are for connecting to things like the keypad, because
right. But those are the expansion, the smaller ones. But the big one.
Yeah, this
it
one
looks
on
like
the,
it was designed to go into something that would provide power, at least. Yeah.
Could be. It has little keys on a keypad that if you read them, say Pilmfmerg. So I'm hoping that is what people called this machine.
That was the name of the designer.
Yeah. Well, that's what Shrewdloo comes from, right? It's the keys down the right edge of a linotype.
Yep.
According to Sorcerer Stan in the chat, it is not S100 compatible. He has either counted the pins or knows something that we don't.
Or both. Quite likely both. Or at least quite likely the latter. So one other thing about the 6800, which is potentially of interest. This is a picture of the Apple One board. And the Apple One board was designed to also work with the 6800. I mean, like it could work either with the 6800 or the 6500. And there's a little section here on the screen. It says on the silk screen, it says 6800 only. And there's little, you know, places to put in little capacitors and resistors and stuff that will specifically work for if you put the 6800 in that spot in the processor spot. And I've just waved the cursor around a spot that is not the processor spot, but here's the processor that I'm now correctly waving across. And actually, Mike Willigal has he builds the Mimeo One replicas of the Apple One, and he has actually put 6800 in one and kind of like, you know, shown how it can be done and that it does work. Or at least he wrote about it. It looks like actually this is possibly somebody else who has done it, but there's a video that shows that area populated for the 6800 and I guess the 6800 in there. Anyway. So that's just a little unrelated things about the 6800. But the development kit itself might be kind of cool to play around with.
Just out of curiosity, on the Apple One board that you were showing, that you hovered your cursor over initially, what is that area with the little jumper cable? Is it a 75? Stop moving it around.
It's a 74154.
154. Okay. So what is that?
I do not know. I assume that those are some sort of options or something that you can configure. But
how much RAM or if you've got an expansion board attached or something like that?
That's possible. Yeah.
Yeah, because the other thing that I remember seeing several years ago at Kansas Fest when that guy brought in his Apple One in a cardboard box.
His actual Apple One. Yeah, I know.
Yeah. Was that the Apple One board had like a little hobbyist area, like a little breadboarding area built into it. I was like, that's so was.
Yeah. It's up there at the top.
Yeah. There's extra space. Why not? I'll just put a little breadboarding area on.
Well, these things weren't worth hundreds of thousands of dollars, you know, back initially. So you do stuff like, you know, solder some fun things on it. The first Apple II actually also had a little board section like that too. Although that got revised away.
Yeah. But it's the sort of thing where, like, we could either just have a big blank space on the board or spread things out a little bit more because, you know, we don't need anything in all this space. But, you know, why not? We'll use it for something that we could actually – you could use for upgrades or for making your own.
I also like the confidence that went into labeling this board Apple Computer 1.
Yeah.
It's sort of like – we know there will be more. Oh, yeah, here's another little socket in C1, I guess, that says 7404, 6800 only. So if you have a 6800 in there, then you want to put put a chip in that slot, in that socket. Okay, anyway, so that was the trainer. What is what's the next thing I have? I don't know. This is just another thing that struck me as it's a tractor feed option kit, which made me think tractor feed. Have you guys come across, maybe you probably have, Hardware Wars, which is the very early Star Wars spoof made like in the same year that Star Wars was released.
Yes.
So when I saw Tractor Feed, I you know, immediately just, you know, thought of the tractor beam joke. I saw this actually several times because libraries had it on 16 millimeter that you could check out. You know, so like my father would check it out and we would watch it, you know. It's a little bit like a video store, except way predated that. So anyway, that's Hardware Wars. Computer Shopper I thought was interesting. So this is you can find a number of these issues, but this one I picked, July 1988, has some stuff about the Atari Mega 4 and the Tandy 5000 and things. But do you guys know Computer Shopper? You must, right?
Yeah, of course. Yeah.
Yeah. So the thing about these is that they're actually surprisingly hard to find and read. Or maybe surprisingly.
Really, they were everywhere. I guess because nobody just hung on to them because you'd think it was disposable.
Yeah, well, I mean, you could buy a physical one on eBay, but I mean, like, if you wanted to read a scanned one, nobody scanned them, and the reason is they are 300 pages of nothing but ads.
Because they're big and they're crazily thick. They're just enormous.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's almost like the auto shopper, like the Kelley Blue Book kind of thing that has a hole drilled in the corner and a big like clamp on the side that you see in the back of a body shop or something, because they're enormous, and it's like, okay, I know I need the parts for a 64 or whatever, and flip 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 flip.
Which is funny because they were
full of computer parts. Yeah.
And so it's the kind of thing that is important and should be archived, but who wants to say, okay, I'm going to archive the July 1982 version of this disposable Computer Shopper magazine and this thin newsprint stuff that would take forever to scan. Yeah. And now you've got like that one issue that was obviated so fast.
Yeah. I mean, most of the magazines that we read, ads are fun and all, but I mean, like, you get a little annoyed when your new soft talk is 90% ads. But this one, just is unashamedly, it is all ads, and occasionally like a couple of articles.
But I mean, it was what it
that
was.
That was the point. Was, yeah.
That was the point. And it wasn't, by the time Computer Shopper was big, I wasn't like a DOS. I wasn't using the computers that were in Computer Shopper. So like, I never looked at it. It was the thing for people that used other things. You'd go buy stuff in it. It wasn't for me.
Yeah. But anyway, I just thought it was kind of strange in a way that it was, it's something that most of us all know, and we're everywhere, and yet they really aren't well reflected. So you can find them on Internet Archive, but you will notice that they are all like from the 2000s, and a lot of them were, like born digital.
But look way more modern than what I think of as Computer Shopper.
You can find, like, here's a June 1986, but it's 15 pages of June 1986 that happened to have Atari articles.
It would have been 400 pages, yeah.
Yeah. So,
they scanned it for the articles.
Yeah, exactly. But yeah, so that's, I mean, the funny thing is about this is that this is something that is not really well preserved. So,
preserved in my mind.
Yeah. One other thing that's related to this is Benj Edwards has a retro scan of the week posting from 2014, the launch of Computer Shopper.
Look how small it is. They were underestimating how big that would get. Yeah. That looks like a regular magazine, not the catalog it became.
It is. Yeah. It was really like, a small city's phone book every month. But so anyway, if anyone wants to scan them, I think it would be neat to see them. But at the same time,
do it, Paul. Do it.
Yeah. Oh, I do not want to scan them. It does sort of seem like, because they are this disposable, I might not feel too bad about cutting the spine.
But you'd have to cut it and get like, so many pages, carefully. And they're glued together. The newsprint, basically, the ones I remember, so rip so easy. It'd be tough to disassemble and not rip things.
Yeah.
Yeah. I was gonna say it's the kind of thing you just put in the guillotine and then. The document scanner.
Yep.
I don't even think I'm going to bother with this one. I'll just mention what it is. It is a T-shirt that says Gigabyte Me from the 1990s because it was the 1990s. I don't know. Somebody thought – SciQuest thought this was a good way to advertise themselves.
Is it a dog or is it a fish? Is it a dog fish?
It's a dog fish.
Okay. I guess it must be, with an actual head of a dog.
I think it could be catfish. It could be dogfish. Why not?
Top of a head of a dog.
Well, I know that there are such things as dogfish, but I don't remember anything around that sort of image around SciQuest.
Yeah. Somebody thought this was a good idea.
It just occurred to me that catfish could have been called piranha.
There you go.
You're banned. I'm banning you. You have been banned.
Missed opportunity.
Paul?
It's worth the ban. I'll take it. I put that into the world, and I regret nothing.
Oh, this actually, this next thing I have is actually sort of related in a way to the computer shopper thing. It is Soft Cell Product Encyclopedia from 1985, and it is similarly, you know, like 300
this
pages.
This I don't know.
Yeah, I mean, like, so it's not something that I know either, and apparently it's not something that merits in-focus photography, but but it's basically just a big catalog of, like, here's some software that was around in 1985, and it's big. You can see it's like, you know, phone book sized. And people published these things because where else would you get this information? So as far as I know, I haven't seen this scanned anywhere. I've seen similar things scanned, but I haven't seen this particular one. And it's the kind of thing that could be useful.
If nothing else, as a checklist for what has been, you know, what has been cracked or not. You know.
Right. Yeah. And actually, I wanted to bring up the Everything Project, which I think is something that Jason Scott promoted for a while, but and maybe still does. I don't know that he has stopped. But I mean, the idea is essentially to go through things like that catalog and make a list of all the things that they list in there, and then try to make sure that, you know, like, we know at least what all the things were supposed to be if they actually got released, so we can see if we have succeeded in at least archiving those that we can find. You know. Mm-hmm. So there's a Google spreadsheet that has a list of basically all the things that were in a couple of these different catalogs. And as people find catalogs, the idea is that they'll be added in here as well. So that might be such a catalog. I'm not sure that I want to spend $90 on it, but at the same time, you know.
Hope somebody else does.
Yeah, right. Anyway, I think the last thing I'll mention is just I thought this was pretty cool. Commodore accessory, just because it actually has a real function. It is a reset button.
It looks like the Control Alt Delete.
Yeah, the specialized keyboard. But yeah, it's essentially what it is. You use up your peripheral spot to add a single button, which will reset your computer. So if you want that,
I love that the auction required two pictures.
Yeah,
two photos of it, the front and the back.
It is one button.
Yep.
That's great.
I think people have commented on that before as being a strange thing about the Commodore 64, that it has no reset button. PET also has no reset button. So
it was an optimistic computer. You won't need that.
I think I do have a push button reset that I am at some point going to install in a PET. It's been sitting on the PET keyboard for probably 8 years. But at some point I will connect those wires.
More fun to connect the wires up and onto somebody else's PET and then run it to like a door jam or something. Or nobody is, whenever that door shuts, this computer resets. Ha! Yeah. Try to figure out why that happens.
Yeah, exactly. It's connect it to some light switch in some other room of the house.
What does this switch do?
Somewhere in the distance you hear
screaming. I think the switch makes noise. Like
it seems to be the screaming switch.
I think it was a Far Side cartoon or Calvin and Hobbes or something where they had a light switch in their house and they're like, I don't know what this does. I'm just going to keep flipping it and you go around the house and nothing's going on. And then meanwhile, down the street, the garage door is open and going conch, conch, conch. And like the door is clashing, you know, on the top of the car. That was great. I did find, by the way, the promo that I was seeing on eBay, and I'll put the link, I'll just put the link here in the show notes there. It was apparently the Comic Con Museum Game Character Hall of Fame. They did the induction of Pac-Man into the Character Hall of Fame, and so there was a promo for some reason there. I mentioned this because the URL for this page this is the first time I've ever seen the trademark symbol in a URL that actually rendered properly. That's cool. and I'm sure it's just coming from their content management system and, you know, taking the title of the article. But yes, Thursday, December 17th, 2020.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Also not today.
Yeah. Yeah.
Right.
unless there's another CC. It's like San Diego Comic-Con Museum, so SDCC yeah. Museum. Unless there's another video game museum that's SDCC.
Also seems like if they're only just getting to Pac-Man, they've got a long ways to go.
Right.
the previous ones were like the asteroids ship, I guess.
It's the Pixel from Pong.
Yeah, that's right.
Pongsel.
They can't all be good.
Yes, they can. Nobody gets me.
It's okay. It's okay. You're unbanned. It's fine.
All right. I guess that's it. We can leave it there. So I guess we made it to the closing discussion part. And Carrington, you have the alphabetical first.
I've got nothing. We were talking before the show started. I've been working on a text adventure, and that's finally technically complete, so it'll go out to beta testing soon, so that's exciting. So finally, this stupid thing I've been working on in dribs and drabs all over the place is going to go out to people to play, so I'm excited about that. I think that's really the only retro thing I've been doing the last couple of weeks. So.
Yeah, we saw a little bit of saw a little of the preview of the art. It looks great. It's going to be great.
So
once it's beta tested, it's going to play great.
Yeah, totally.
So Charles, how about any closing thoughts from you?
Thoughts, yes. Closing ones, no. As far as projects go, I have declared 2022 to be my year of no new projects. So I am focusing all of my hobby energy on either finishing up or handing off or closing down projects that have been ongoing for however long. So finishing up things that I started for Hackfest that never turned into an actual like game, publishing the source on GitHub, things like that. I'm really finally, honestly trying to get around to get all of the information from Retro Connector, all the adapters and doodads and things that I made for a while that I haven't made in several years now because job and time and sanity, handing those off to Reactive Micro, getting them, bill of materials and all the source materials. They have a few of my things in their store already, but, I'm finally like, okay, I need to get this stuff to you so that it has a life after me. I've basically just been doing that. That's my, going through my list of projects and deciding what I want to actually try and hand off or work on that is not new, but as long suffering.
Yeah, I think that's kind of what I've. I feel like that's kind of the mode I'm in as well. And like in the domain I'm working in is basically like the stuff I've been collecting. And so I'm trying to move through that and process it and finish it and whatever. Yeah, it's I'm getting there. And one of the things that expedited this a little bit was that it turned out, I forget now, it was must have been like a couple weeks ago, there was water, in our basement. And, it was like 6 inches or something like that. And I think it was some sort of like a, city water pipe or something nearby. It wasn't, even though there had been a lot of snow and rain, it wasn't actually related to that directly. But at any rate, so mostly everything was up on little pedestals, but there were a few things that were like, I think what had happened, cardboard boxes do this, everybody should know this, but after a while, they don't hold all of their sturdiness and the top ones will topple off. And so actually also most of my stuff is in plastic bins, but the stuff that was way up, I thought, that's fine. It can be in cardboard, but of course the cardboard toppled off onto the floor. So it was then lower than the pedestals. Right. And so there were a few things that were kind of unsalvageable. And I think, frustrating. Yeah. But they were just soaked through.
Yeah. When the cardboard is perfectly dry, it's nice and sturdy, but if it's in a high humidity atmosphere, it just kind of softens and then whatever's on top of it crushes a little bit and then falls over. Yeah.
And it normally is not a high humidity. Like generally speaking,
there's not 6 inches of water in your basement, but
right. So that was, it was annoying. And I was lucky. I mean, like, I think that the things that I did have to get rid of are things that pretty much exist, you know, out there in other people's collections also. And, you know, I sort of salvaged what I could, but it's still annoying. It's still very annoying.
Sucks.
And so it also makes me feel that this is even more urgent. Like, I do not want to be responsible for this getting soaked. If I can pass it on to someone else who, you know, it's their fault that it gets soaked, that's fine.
That's okay.
But,
or ship it to yourself, and so if it breaks, it's FedEx's fault, and you can't take any blame.
But yeah, and I mean, I've been making progress. It actually is much slower than I had expected, but I'm getting through things. So, Michael shows up as we are in the last
and let's start
seconds.
Again.
But good morning, Michael. We were just speaking of water, and I think Michael, one of the things that was at least a challenge for Michael participating this time was the fact that his bunker is also full of moisture, and apparently, so. I don't know what the status is of that, but maybe we will hear next time. I think it sounded like from the email we got that stuff was relatively safe, but, you know, still with fans and dehumidifiers and stuff running. So I think that's basically it. So is that it? Everybody happy with that?
I have no more closing. I have no more closing thoughts.
Okay, then I will say that is it for this show. You can find the show notes for this and all the RCR shows at rcrpodcast.com. You can discuss the show in the forums at bcfed.org/forum/forum.php. You can follow RCR on Twitter at rcrpodcast. You can join our Facebook group at facebook.com/groups/rcrpodcast. You can send feedback to feedback@rcrpodcast.com. Things are falling over left and right. We've got a puppet participating now in the dancing.
I've been called worse.
All right. Anyway, where were we? I think we were at this point members of the Throwback Network at throwbackreviews.com. Please write a review on iTunes if you like. And until next time,
Retro Compute. Nailed it.
Yeah.
What's your problem, Admiral?